Welcome to the Real Estate Lowdown. I'm your host, Bill Bimel. The Real Estate Lowdown is your weekly opportunity to step into the conversations going on in today's real estate and mortgage markets. We explore terms and concepts of the industry, host interviews of intriguing industry cohorts from high net worth investors to real estate agents just making their mark. We will share our love of all things real estate, bringing you the most innovative and sustainable real estate lifestyle ideas each and every week. If you enjoy what you hear today, hit the follow button, subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and please share your support with a quick review. You can find me on the web at billbimel.com, and thanks for joining this episode of the Real Estate Lowdown. I am so excited today to have a very close friend of mine. I know I consider you close. I hope you consider me your friend, Spencer Lee. But welcome to the Real Estate Lowdown.
Thanks for having me. Yes, the feeling is mutual, Bill.
You know, it was funny. You know, we've known each other for a while and we've done some business together. We've dined together. You know, you were kind enough as a Harvard graduate, as I, you know, to invite me to the Harvard Club. And I was so honored to have lunch with you and your partner there. But it was interesting that you actually, what I didn't remember until this morning when I was looking at your bio again, was that you were an EVP of asset management at Arch Bay Capital, which from back in the day of, for those of us that were around right around the GFC, Arch Bay was, I wouldn't say the 800-pound gorilla, because it was more like, you know, the 400-pound gorilla that lived a short life.
Yeah, it's pretty accurate. That's great. You know, it was one of the larger sort of credit funds, basically came to be during the prior crisis. The original, the founding principals had been folks that had been, you know, sort of the mortgage space for years, and essentially sort of thought this kind of event, you know, the sort of the great credit crisis was coming, and it essentially sort of geared themselves up for that. It was a wild time, you know, because I don't think that we as a country or as an industry had seen that type of dynamic in the housing market, you know, essentially since the S&L crisis, mm-hmm. right? And that was coming on the back of really probably sort of an accelerating decade plus, you know, maybe 15 years plus of just housing appreciation, creative financing, structured financing, all these sort of like, you know, it wasn't just, hey, I'm going to go to my local bank and get a mortgage. Okay, put 20% down. Here's the rate, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you're all these sort of exotic products, new products at the consumer yeah. level.
Right? Sounds familiar.
Like low down payment, negative. And then, you know, Wall Street sort of getting into this, just the whole securitization and how you do asset-backed loans, just sort of, you know, proliferating, and then just broad liquidity, right? And it just created this massive house of cards. So that's kind of where, you know, so that's what made, you know, sort of that time so interesting. And Arch Bay found itself right in the middle of it. And I joined there in 2009. I think at its peak, we were managing like $3.5 billion notional, and it was wild. I mean, it was wild. And we had this philosophy where we would just really try to kind of get into the trenches. So, you know, lots of REO tours, going all around the country, like going to lawyers' offices. And I remember going to a well-known firm in Florida where if I, you know, protect the innocent, but if I were to share the name, like we would all remember it.
Oh, yeah.
And going in there and seeing literally walking between stacks of filings like we got into a hoarder's house. I mean, it was just crazy. And I will give you one more amazing, amazing anecdote from a law firm visit. We literally went to another law firm in Florida, and we were talking to them about, hey, like, we want to move our files. This is our strategy. This is what we want you to do. And they literally looked us in the face and said, hey, look, this is what the allowables are. This is the schedule that we get paid on them for them. And really, basically, we get 2/3 of our fee by just taking something to First Legal. Like, so really, you want to know what we do? is you basically take, as soon as you get a referral, you take it to First Legal, and then basically it sort of sits in the pile, and if it gets done, it gets done. And it was just like, oh my God, this is crazy.
But you're actually telling me this?
I, you know? But that was the environment. But it is just an amazingly fascinating environment, especially in retrospect.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, totally. I mean, and so were you young to the industry when all this was going on? I mean, what was your perspective on it? I mean, obviously it was a whole, we kind of had different experiences of that same world. You were at a big billion-dollar fund that was spending tons of money. And what stage of your career and your life were you in and at that point?
Yeah, sure. So I was not a mortgage guy at that point in time. I actually had come from credit cards prior. So which is a really super, also a super interesting kind of asset class, because the size is very different when you look at a credit card debt. A single piece of credit card debt, it is almost always much smaller, obviously, than a mortgage. I worked at a credit card issuer, monoline credit card issuer, that predominantly focused on the student market, you know, very well-honed operation. But, you know, in credit cards, because it's unsecured debt, you know, your collections and delinquency operations are vital to your financial performance, you know, regardless of the fact that you're charging, you know, interest rates that are
ridiculous,
massive multiples, you know, because you have nothing to secure it by, right?
Right.
And so the approach to collections, the approach to delinquency, the technologies, you know, how you actually deploy resources and collecting money in that space is very different, because the balances are so much smaller. Mm-hmm. So you have to be much more thoughtful, you have to be much more strategic, you know, all these kinds of things. But that was my background. So really, I kind of came up through financial services on the corporate institutional side, moved to the sort of consumer finance side, into credit cards, and then I got into mortgages after that. And that's how I got over.
And then the long, beautiful career started. So it's interesting, because, you know, it really, now I'm starting to see the picture, because, you know, whether it was on the credit card side where you're dealing with massive numbers of accounts, you know, in terms of millions of dollars, you know, in small increments, or you get into distressed resi at a time when the servicers were way overloaded. And really, from a perspective, you're talking larger balances, but there were thousands and thousands. So you've really had to deal with these massive delinquency issues on a larger, more macro scale than kind of the approach that I came up through, which was, you know, starting one or two or 100 properties at a time. You know, that's, I guess, why you've had to really utilize technology so much, right? And that's kind of what your forte has been. I mean, so I've used your software. We can talk about that. We can, but I'd rather just use your brain right now, which is because you're certainly on the front line. Just tell a little bit, just take a minute and talk a little bit about, you know, what you've developed in your company so that folks have some understanding of your perspective, because I want to talk about where the market's going after that.
Sure. And so, yeah, you're spot on, right? In terms of characterizing, especially an asset class like credit cards, right? You can use the law of large numbers,
right?
And you don't need to create a lot of lift to create a sizable financial outcome, right? Because it's those small lifts, those incremental lifts that have large sort of leverageable outcomes. And really, that's what technology is supposed to be for the user in any context, right? Which is, technology should fundamentally improve productivity, right? Why is a word processing software useful to you, right? It's because you can write in a dramatically more efficient way than you ever, you know, could before, right? Like, if you look at the way we type, with an error rate that would be unacceptable 20, 30, 40 years ago, right? When we were sitting there with typewriters, right? Right?
That's right. But think about all the recarbons you'd have to do.
Yeah. But the technology sort of makes it, not only just makes it forgivable, like, you're still more efficient that way, right? So I started Red Hawk Research in 2013 with my partner. Our goal was really to build products within domains that we understand to solve these domain-specific issues. Now, when I was at Arch Bay running asset management, like, We were trying to do with a $3.5 billion portfolio what you were doing with a portfolio of 100 loans, right? Like
Right.
when you're a whole loan guy, you gotta go in loan by loan. Like you just, the idea of sitting behind spreadsheets and trying to just monitor cash flows is just untenable.
Right.
And so, you know, we were winding down in 2013, late 2012, 2013, actually. And to the very bitter end, I had eight people on my team going through foreclosures and bankruptcies, just trying to move assets through the process because it is, you have to look at an asset. You have to know what's going on. You have to know what jurisdiction it is. You have to understand like who the borrower is and what their behavior is and where it is. And the hardest part about it was the communication cycle, right? Like you just don't know where that asset is in the process, especially in a state like New York or Illinois or Florida, where these judicial processes are awfully long and they become very, very opaque and you have very, very little information that's coming to you to actually use, right? Now, what we always sort of had this mindset of how can we find sort of technology or use data or create solutions that give us leverage, give us productivity. And you know, unfortunately, we were sort of in that wind down mode by the time we sort of really begun to kind of figure this out. But that data exists out there, right? That data actually exists. So, you know, the way investors typically get information for foreclosure, for instance, is you just get these sort of standard six milestones and it's sort of a one size fits all. And the problem is in a state like New York, you would get to service complete and you're trying to get to judgment entered. And in downstate New York, that's a 3-year step, right?
Right.
So how do you
How do you
know if your
monitor
asset is good or
that?
bad? Right. The only way you can do it is so you have to sort of like go in there and like literally with your hands and dig around and make phone calls and all this kind of stuff.
Which is
But
what
there
we
is data that,
do.
right. But there is data out there in these default administration platforms. It's just extraordinarily messy, extraordinarily noisy, and you have to like work hard to put it together. But it exists. And so that was one of the problems that, you know, I knew given my experience in the domain existed and how to think about it. And so my partner and I sort of built our original Jonah platform to do that. So in Jonah itself, we arrayed the New York State process in over 20 steps. And it's all the state-specific steps, right? Such that you can know in that state-specific step how long you've been there. Right. And so that timeline performance serves as that just sort of North Star to make sure you're not going massively sideways. And the biggest benefit of that is simply a resource allocation, you know, question, right? You can look at the assets when you need to look at them. And fundamentally, that's what all the products that we've built are really oriented around, making sure you look at and are able to remedy the things that you need. Because we sort of build on the you know, principles of transparency, actionable metrics, and you know, the proper level of abstraction, right? So that every single time you can be effective.
Yeah, and I've used the software. I'm not here to be your advertising plug, but I will tell you that it was recommended to me by one of the more respectable institutional investment firms that I have done business with it over the last couple of years that is a client of yours. I've loved every time I've been inside of it. And then your Jonah Direct is really exciting. That's a newer product, which is really more meant for the individual or even smaller investor. Now, large investors can use that platform too, but it basically, if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, Jonah Direct basically walks an investor through the servicer surveillance process of taking in a non-performing loan through foreclosure or some kind of resolution. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So the Jonah Direct platform is fundamentally a collaborative platform, right? To administer that whole default process, right? Whether it's foreclosure or bankruptcy, right? So a servicer can use it instead of their default administration platform to work with their attorney to move that asset through a specific process. An investor can use it, right, to communicate with their attorney or with the servicer or whatnot. You can bring in external parties. But the whole idea is create a centralized collaborative environment for you to actually work in that. So you can store and you know store docs in there. You can you know assign tasks in there. You have your timeline budgets, everything in there, and it's all very well laid out, right? Just so that you can, in a really intuitive way, like the design of our applications has been as important to us as the functionality, because if folks can operate in a function, operate in an environment that's intuitive, and they're just going to be more productive.
Right. And, you know, a lot of folks that are trying to segue, you know, one of the things that I think that the GFC did that was so wonderful is that it democratized or really brought to the masses the investment tool of buying mortgage notes. Now, it had been around for a long time. Seller financing had been around forever, right? However, this whole access to the secondary market, or the ability of people to buy one-off notes and all that, it, because of the plethora of NPL, that market, you know, came about. And so you have a lot of folks who see, you know, just like instead of having rental properties, they own mortgages in a 401k or in an investment account. And it's a way for people to have it as a side job, you know, like they don't have to spend their whole time in creating it by having the, you know, tools and technologies like this. So, you know, there's no doubt there's value. I want to turn to the market itself, because you obviously are in it from two perspectives. A, you're a brilliant guy. You're always watching the real estate market. You've been around it for now a couple decades in the heart of it, both as an investor and an analyst and provider of data. So you've seen it from that perspective. And also now you see it from the perspective of providing tools to people who are managing non-performing assets. And here we are in February of 2024. And, you know, we're coming off of over a decade now of upward real estate prices, and things are just strange. It's just strange, right? You know, I don't know how else to describe it, you know, and I'm done predicting the business. What's the data say, my friend? What is Red Hawk Research's perspective on the world?
Oh, man. So first of all, both of us were, I think, in alignment about a year ago on where we thought things would go. And both of us are definitely wrong, unfortunately, you know? So, I mean, look, I personally just struggled with like, what is going on? I mean, you know, like, have we actually pulled off a soft landing? Like, this is crazy. And it's just so interesting to sort of, if the traditional way, right, you think about macroeconomics, right, is like low rates occur and exist because there's a crisis going on, right? But there's this expectation now that the Fed lowers rates just because inflation has gone down, right? Not because there's a crisis and there's a need to sort of like stimulate the economy out of a crisis, right? You almost wonder whether part of that is fundamentally attributable to this understanding that there's this wave of commercial real estate coming due, right? And does the lending environment need to be sort of teed up in order to basically prevent a massive crisis, because you just fundamentally can't lend anything near and these debt holders can't bear anything, you know, sort of, you know, at these current levels. So, you know, I'm curious about that. I don't know what you think.
Okay, I'm back to predicting the future. you want the part of the media, the frontline media is saying soft landing, things are great. But then you've got this whole world of like an article I read in The Economist this week. Like the frontline article is, if the economy is so good, why does everyone feel so down? You know, and it's no doubt that everyone I talk to across every social economic level in this country does not have, I don't hear positivity. I'm fortunate to be able to hang out with all different kinds of folks. I was at a Super Bowl party in Palm Beach listening to millionaires complain about how they can't afford to live in Florida. That's just one, you know, that's one end of the spectrum. And then we all know, and then I'm in Los Angeles. And if there are pockets of Los Angeles, unincorporated Los Angeles, that allows parking, overnight parking of commercial vehicles.
Right.
Those areas are now lined with
RVs, right? All over the place.
That's right. It is. I've never seen anything like it. I don't know why it doesn't get more attention. And, you know, I know we work with a nonprofit in Florida on that, with our HUD homes. I was just talking with the CEO there. She's every day meeting more and more people who are like people with jobs living out of cars with children that have full-time jobs. So, you know, one would like to say the reality is that the Fed needs to keep rates too, because they got to keep tools in their toolbox, because what goes up must come down in some regard, right? You know, we must hit a breaking point. You know, as much as we all want to believe that residential real estate will never go down, we all believed that in 2006 too.
That's true. And you know, it's interesting. So you ask, like, what does the data tell us? Like, you know, we've got broad data, you know, across all the states, you know, various, you know, sort of various dimensions. And really what we've seen in that is that timelines for default are actually beginning to shorten. We essentially construct synthetic timelines, and for the first time in a while, they're starting to shorten, and these default processes are starting to pick up in big states like California, New York, Florida. It's very slow, right? So it's not as if like it's super obvious, but you know, at that, it's kind of like watching the next set of waves come in, right? You see the wave coming in, but it's all at early stages right now, all at early stages of the foreclosure process. It's not like a bunch of sales getting scheduled.
Yeah, so. And that may just be what, listen, I think that, I guess the if I had to correct my predictions, if the one thing we all just never could really factor is what is the effect of the $6 trillion of government money printing and how long did it take for those accounts to dry out? We're starting to see, you know, credit card debts building up and more defaults in the auto and non-secured sectors as well. And you're right, if it's just a little bit of a tick, but that's a theory, in theory, that would be the start of a trend that might increase. You know, it just makes sense because something has to normalize in terms of of affordability. And you know, it's good. This is, you know, it's good. You know, unfortunately, in every cycle, there are winners and losers. It's not a zero-sum game by any means. In the long run, the economy, the value of things trends upwards. But who knows? Who knows? I'll stop making predictions. Yeah. Well, it's been really amazing, you know, talking to you about this. Can we make a promise that we get together at least once a year on the podcast and check in? I mean, actually, I wouldn't even mind if we could make a third or fourth quarter rollback and look at this and see where the trends are going from here.
Let's do it.
Well, Spencer,
that'll be fun.
It's been great to be with you. Thanks for joining the Real Estate Lowdown.
And Bill, thanks for the time.
That's a wrap of today's episode of the Real Estate Lowdown. I enjoy bringing this content to you each and every week, and I really appreciate you tuning in. If you haven't already done so, please share the Real Estate Lowdown or any episode, any favorite episode, with your friends, family, and, you know, if you don't mind, leave a positive review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Remember to follow us so you do get notified every time a new episode is released. Love to hear from you directly at billbymel.com. Till then, see you next time.